It's a pleasure being here. I hope I'm not too noisy because I'm not a big fan of speaking with this hidden device, but I heard it's important for giving a verification to the community. Okay, so what I'm speaking about may be sounding quite different from what you are used to here, but you will see certain connections and also why I'm coming as what I consider, sorry, a real many-body theoretician to this audience here. So what we have been working in general is superconductivity in the high TC compounds. And the issue there is that you have a Hamiltonian as accurately as possible, and this is where my $20 will go, namely at high energies where you have, say, Hubbard-U interactions or electron-electron interaction in general, they may be of the order of 10 electron volts. And then the general issue or the challenge is to go down in a very controlled manner to the milli-electron volts where the superconductivity K. Boltzmann TC is really sitting. And I would like to discuss with you a scheme we have recently worked on, which we consider very powerful, and this is the functional renormalization group scheme. I will also briefly mention other schemes we have been working on. For example, with Su Sheng Zhang, we have devised a kind of new symmetry, the SO5 symmetry. I'll explain this also, going from high energy via sort of a magnifying glass, which is the symmetry, or here the renormalization group, down to low energy. Okay, and specifically I would like to address this new high TC superconductor, which is of interest to a large number of people right now. The work has been done with an excellent graduate student, Christian Platt, who is now actually also in Princeton, Carsten Honerkamp, who just got a chair at the RWTH Aachen, Aachen University, Ronnie Tomale, who is a postdoc now also with Bernevik in Princeton, and as I said, with Su Sheng Zhang. Okay, so why are people excited about these new iron-based superconductors? Well, the excitement is plotted here. So here you have TC versus some H number, and here you have these new superconductors which have not yet reached the liquid nitrogen temperature, which would be then also important for practical use, but they still are the second largest high TC family around, beyond the famous high TC cuprates. So the interest in these materials is, and you will see that, they are very different from the cuprates. So indeed, they are not the cuprates at all. They are weakly correlated, they are multi-band materials. The cuprates are strongly correlated, basically one-band materials. And so this new family offers the possibility to ask a question, what is universal about superconductivity and what is specific? And I hope I can convince you that indeed we have found in general, not just our group, but a number of groups, that there is a universality issue, namely the superconductivity is electronic or magnetic in nature. And I will also tell you about things which are clearly material oriented. These new compounds come in a variety, but you will see they're actually kind of similar. Again, like in the cuprates, we have iron atoms forming a plane, and then a big player is the arsenic green atom, which is displaced out of the plane. You have some other filling spacing layers which act as dopants, and they are all related to this family of digital-coorganoids. So what would I like to do in my talk? Well, first of all, I give you a pretty extensive introduction, which actually comprises also the second chapter here. This is to give you an idea what is the electronic structure of these compounds. Here you see again the iron, red ions surrounded by the arsenic and then some spacing layers. So what is the electronic structure? How can we construct using density functional theory and some other concepts, a high energy Hamiltonian. So this will be my starting point. So I'll actually spend some 15 minutes or around this to get you familiar with the electronic structure of these nictides. Then my main issue is embedded in these next chapters. I'm interested in the competing magnetic superconducting orders at low temperatures, so I would like to describe to you how we can address with modern techniques this issue. And for the nictides, we consider the method of choice the functional randomization group, and I will also tell you that we can use this for a variety of different materials. And when I do this, my main $20 issue will come up. Namely, what we are working on and interested in is making a contact with what you can do so well here, namely a kind of first principle many-body description at high energies, let's say at a density functional type of level of calculation. And this as an input we can use then to get a very accurate description of the low energy physics. Okay, and then we will compare all the superconductivity and work on the issue, what is universal and what is material dependent. This is, I think, a misspelling in these materials. Okay, why are we motivated? Well, I already told you a general issue why we are motivated, because these materials are very different in many aspects from the Cooperites, weak correlation, many bands, multiple disconnected Fermi surfaces, you will see them very soon, will allow very interesting superconducting ground states not encountered before. You have learned in textbook solid state physics, if you have an S-wave superconductor like lead or aluminum, you have an S-wave superconductivity which doesn't have a node, so it's nodeless, it has a more or less constant gap. This is no longer true for the nictides, and this is due to the Fermi surface topology. Okay, there are commonalities which I will now address, but also differences. These are the material properties we have also to consider. So for example, we can look at the oxy nictides. This is this family again with the iron atoms and the arsenic atoms displaced. So for example, I'm looking here, and this is mainly what I'm discussing now out of work. Doug Scalapino here was involved with the Florida group around Peter Hirschfeld. They did a number of LDA density functional type of calculations, some of which I will address. These were calculations by different groups, but the main issue, there are commonalities. And what are they? Well, here around the Fermi level, you have a hole pocket around the CO0 gamma point, and you have an electron or more electron pockets around the M point. And this you see here and here in different materials.
What time did your oval slide downwards underground?
Oh, I don't know. This was done by
used to be up here.
Absolutely. Maybe this is Santa Barbara. Everything goes down to Earth. I have no idea. Good question. The second point is, you can just look at these Fermi surface sheets, which are around the gamma point or around the M points, and they are very strongly 2D. So the material, like the Cooperite, in this respect, there's a similarity, has the copper in the Cooperites, but here the iron sheets, where I have the arsenic atoms a little bit displaced, and a lot of the physics is 2D. But a big difference to the Cooperites, the density of states at the Fermi level is comprised of all the 3D orbits of iron, and you will see that also the 4P arsenic physics is mixed into. But sort of an overall short look at the density of states, which is plotted here versus energy, and here is the Fermi level, gives you clearly an indication that this green dashed line is doing the main job, namely the D levels give rise to the main density of states. Yeah.
In this picture, the hole pockets look as if it comes in two varieties, one of which is actually three-dimensional.
That's correct. I mean, this was a sort of a very quick statement. There are three-dimensional effects in this material, and this also, the weight of 3D behavior is slightly varying. And I will come back to this issue because this has also some important, at least material, influence. But this is an overall sort of gross simplification. Also, a gross simplification, at least from my point of view, is the following. People have done electron phonon standard response function calculations for this material. This is not now the spaghetti of the density functional theory, but the spaghetti of the phonons. And then you see here a phonon density of states. What we would like to have in superconductivity is, of course, alpha squared f of omega, which directly then determines the corresponding electron phonon coupling lambda. But this is basically the density of states, as you see. And when people do, like Mrs. Boeri, the calculation, then they come up with a lambda value, which is of the order of 0.2 or 0.3, depending on the calculation. And this is way too small. You need something of the order of 1 to explain the superconducting properties. So again, like in the Couperts, we have a situation that clearly another mechanism is mainly at work. Okay, so now I would like to come to emerging orders, if you like. So there is a competition with magnetism, and this is due to the fact that these density functional calculations give you a competing SDW state, which is lower in energy than if you do the calculation without the spin polarized version. In the Couperts, you would have this simple anti-ferromagnet, which has all the spins of basically S1/2 on the copper sides, anti-ferromagnetically ordered over the plane. In these materials, there is a ferromagnetic direction and there is an anti-ferromagnetic direction, and you can say you have a pi zero SDW state, which gives you the lowest energy. Now, clearly, the magnetic features and the lattice structure are interwoven. And this you can see by a parameter which I now would like to discuss, because it plays later a role in the many-body Hamiltonian I'm addressing, and this is the Hund-Sruhe coupling. If one looks at the valency of the surrounding ions, one takes away that the ion moment is 2+, and this means that we have these 6 electrons we can distribute over the d levels of ion. And if I assume for the moment, as a toy model, this is not what is realized, an octahedral environment, then you would assume that if the Hund-Sruhe coupling, which we'll see in detail, favors a large spin state, would give rise to an arrangement of these orbitals like this. I have some splitting, and I would get an S equal to local ferromagnetic spin state. If, on the other hand, crystal field dominates, I would expect to get an S equal zero local ground state.
So that doubly occupied
Okay.
When you're doubly occupied TPG state, that looks like it's just right, the point from the iron to the oxygens.
That's correct. I mean, that's but that's not what really the symmetry is really different. So people in density functional theory have played around with the actually observed tetrahedral environment, which is also not ideal in all compounds. But let's assume that I have an ideal tetrahedral environment. And this then still gives rise to the splitting, but the splitting is inverted. So I have here T2G and an EG below, and then I would expect that if I have a Hund-Sruhe coupling, I have again an S equal 2 state here or here. This more complex state is due to the fact that band effects, also hybridization effects, lead to a more detailed splitting of these D levels. We will see this also later. later. And so you have on the ferromagnetic side a high spin state. Now actually the puzzle is that when they look at the magnetic, so to speak, overall system, then the moment is typically 0.3 mu bor. So it's a relatively small moment. So a big issue in these compounds is where does then in the effect of coupling the ions, the small moment come from? Well, excuse me?
What's the moment?
0.3 mu bor. This is the spin moment which you get after doing the many body whatever spin Heisenberg Tower of calculation for the total system. And people have done a kind of Heisenberg local picture calculation where because of the lattice structure you can convince yourself that the nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor couplings are sort of the same magnitude, and because of that and the lattice structure you get a frustrated magnetism which some people attribute to the small moment. But the only thing I would like to make you sort of sensitive to you to is that one can also change the c-axis. This comes back to your three-dimensional question, and one finds if one does the c-axis perpendicular to the plane change, then one also changes very dramatically the local ion moment. So there seems to be a coupling of magnetism and magnetic behavior to the lattice.
Those are all theoretical estimates of the moments?
Exactly.
What's the experimental?
I think also of the order of 0.4 mu bor. Doug knows this probably better. I mean, this is an overall number for these compounds.
That's what materials
yeah, sure.
are as small as 0.3 and some are as large as 0.9 or 1.
Right. So there's a variety, but let's say the overall statement is none goes up to this very large local ion magnetic S equal 2 state. So there must be some other mechanism at play. And the only thing I want you to take away at this point is Hunsrück coupling seems to play a role in these compounds. Now let's go further and look at the electronic behavior close to the Fermi level. I'm interested in superconductivity. So what do we have to take into account? Clearly we have to take into account in principle 16 orbitals, 5 for the two ion atoms in the unit cell. I'll show you the unit cell in a second. And 2 times 3 for these arsenic ions also in the unit cell. I already told you that I have spacing layers which provide the doping. There's a description in terms of just the ion d orbitals possible, but actually the arsenic ions are indirectly involved, so the particles hop onto the arsenic and then hop back to an ion atom, so there is clearly a hybridization with the d bands which takes the influence of the arsenic p orbitals into account. Now, I have to make you familiar with this picture because I will address the Fermi surface sheets, which I mentioned before, in more detail. So I already mentioned that we have a two-dimensional plane of these iron atoms, but the arsenic is not like the oxygen in the cooper, it's in the plane, but it is displaced. Okay? Now, in principle, I have 8 atoms per unit cell, 2 ions in particular, and if you allow me to do an approximation, which many people have used, I can just work with a simplified reduced unit cell, which just comprises 1 ion atom. Okay? This is the reduced unit cell just having 1 ion in the cell. This is the full unit cell. So of course, if I go then to reciprocal space, in the reduced picture with just 1 ion, I have a large unit cell where I have, for example, here the corresponding pockets. And to get to the real Brillouin zone corresponding to the old 2 ion problem I start with, I have to backfold around this line this part, and then I get, for example, these 2 pockets we have seen already in a type of 3D picture at the gamma point, and these are hole pockets and these are electron pockets around the end point. Okay, so now you can construct a variety of type binding models and confront these models with the actual density functional calculations. And here, for example, you have a simple picture where these orbitals and the corresponding particles hop position. But at the end of the day, what has turned out is that one has to take a minimal model. This is a typical theoretical physics talk. Somehow I lost my... this way. So in the end of the day, you have all the 5D orbitals to describe the density functional band structure, for example, done here by the Florida group around Peter Hirschfeld. Okay? And this one can, of course, fit by standard means. And here you see the density functional band structure deviates only very little. These are these black lines from this fit. And here you already see the main orbital weights. So without going at this point into the details, we have a lot of orbital weights entering differently the Fermi surface topology. Okay? So this is my so-called non-interacting part, and later I will address the question that, of course, this non-interacting part already as an LDA type of calculation contains many-body interactions. So then we have to add an interaction Hamiltonian because, of course, we are interested in how are the superconducting properties influenced by the many-body physics.
And now
you have
simplified one
atom
or something?
Sorry, I did not.
Simplify UNCell with one iron atom?
Yeah, you can.
That's
but,
what's in your hand.
Yeah, but I will switch because people typically switch from the real two iron to the one iron, so I'll make it hopefully clear what sort of balance zone I'm using. Okay? So
I would assume that your one iron model cannot be in very close correspondence to the DFT band structures.
Well, there are some differences as far as I know. Dark knows this better because they have used this band structure as an input to the RPA. As far as I know, this fit was done for the two iron per unit cell. And the deviation is very small. But as far as I also know, if you just work with the simplification of one ion per unit cell, nevertheless, the deviations very close to the Fermi level are very, very small. So that's, I think, a fair statement. So now I'm going to the interaction Hamiltonian. And at this point, this is one of the main issues of my talk. This is kind of a toy model. Yeah. So for example, you see here a term which I have already addressed. Namely, because of the lattice magnon or spin coupling, we have a Hounsfield coupling, which favors a high spin state. Notice there's a minus sign in front of the J. Now, if we assume a single two-body interaction term for the interaction physics here, then we have also a corresponding exchange term, an exchange to the subterm. This is this term. This term plays a role later. So let me quickly say what it is. For example, this describes, if you like, a Cooper pair with opposite spin in this orbital T at site I, and then I can scatter or create a new Cooper pair with orbital S at the same site. So this is a kind of a Cooper hopping, pair hopping term. Then we have a new intra-orbital term. This is our old friend we have already in the one-band Hubbard model. And we have an inter-orbital from S to T, but still on-site term. So this is, at this point, what people typically use as a starting point for the many-body physics in these materials. And of course, this is still on a level of an empirical or toy model, because you have double countings. You would like to know in detail how big these numbers are, and I will say something later to this issue. This has, at this point, four adjustable parameters, which however are connected by this requirement that the V, the U, the J, and J prime are determining each other because this is a two-body interaction. But that not necessarily, that's another good point, holds this relation because this assumes as a starting point the bare interaction. Now I have, of course, when I do a density functional calculation, screened interactions, and so not necessarily this relation holds, and this is one of the issues I'm very interested in. So there may be modifications. So the upshot is, I think it is time, and I will mention this later, to do for these parameters and for the interaction Hamiltonian a more serious job, like doing a combination of density functional theory and DFT or a GW calculation, and we'll come back later.
J going to be closely related to something like a T squared over U?
Only in a local picture, but the point is that in these compounds, one is, in my opinion at least, just intermediate between a local picture and an itinerant one, and I will give you evidence for this. Okay, so let me now come more quickly to what I really would like to discuss, namely, why am I interested in a functional RG? Okay, one finds that if one does, for example, constraint density function calculation, the Hubbard U is smaller than the bandwidth W, which is of order 5 eV, and that's again very different from the couplets where these numbers are very equal. And that means you can get away with a weaker coupling many-body scheme. Okay? Now, I told you already electron-phonon coupling small, so this means electron-electron interaction are clearly very important. Another complication compared to the couplets is all five orbitals contribute. So, as you will see, we have to go to a different scheme from what we have been doing in the couplets, and I'll explain that. And this is the functional RG. This is more for the experts. There are clearly interesting questions about the gap symmetry, but I'm not going into this here. There has been actually very beautiful work by a Doug, pioneering work using the RPA. But I would like to discuss a different scheme here. The RPA is very powerful, but as you know, it describes the singularity in one channel. So you would like do, for example, a charge density wave calculation of the response function, and then the instability is in this charge channel. What we can do with the FRG is we have competition with all kinds of diverging channels. And you will see this is very important. So in the couplets, for example, I show you some pictures where you see that at a high temperature, there's an STW or anti-ferromagnetic instability, and at low temperature, this drives the superconductivity. This you can see very nicely in this functional RG treatment. So it does go beyond mean field in discussing these competing phases. So this is one of my favorite pictures because I think this is what I'm interested in and many people are interested in at present. So we know, let's say, the physics, as we usually do, of interacting electrons and ions at this high energy scale of the Hubbard U or whatever, 10 electron volts. So now I have to go, for example, with a randomization group technique and integrate out the high energy degrees of freedom, and then, for example, in the couplets, that was your question, one may or may not enter an unstable fixed point, which is the TJ model, and then eventually I'm resolving these competing phases, magnetic, superconducting, phase separated, whatnot. Okay, in the couplets, this was not possible because of the strong correlation. Yeah, the RG works only in the intermediate or weakly correlated regime, so it's the method of choice for the PNICTiles, not for the couplets. what we did at the Kuberts was we had some work with Su Sheng Zhang, which I mentioned, where we used symmetry to distinguish between these competing orders. So we had a tough statement that whenever we have magnetism, we have superconductivity of a symmetry related to the symmetry of the magnetic behavior, and this prediction, so to speak, is out, and we'll see what happens with that. That's the so-called SO5 theory on which I work with some. Now, in the Kuberts, as I said, we can't do RG. So what we did in the Kuberts was then we used, for example, embedded cluster schemes, which allow us to go in a controlled manner from the cluster to the infinite system size. Why do I want the infinite system size? Well, that's very simple, general physics. These competing orders are nearly degenerate in energy. So you need to resolve very little energy changes, and that always means you have to go to a large system. And this is allowed, for example, by the self-energy approach, which you may know, where one calculates the self-energy in a cluster, but then proliferates the cluster information via a variational principle to the infinite system size. This does not work for the nictites, on the other hand. That's the challenge, because we have so many orbitals. So this is a many-orbital system, and we cannot diagonalize these small clusters. Not even with quantum Monte Carlo we can do this effectively. That's why we believe the RG is the choice of the day, so to speak. If I'll show you this in a minute, because I have the diagrams or the physics for the RG makes a cutoff where you can justify this cutoff only, I will make it very clear in a minute, if I have a weaker Kullo collision. I'll tell you precisely where this enters.
It's not in principle.
Well, but then you have an infinite number of coupled differential equations and it doesn't work. So I'll show you this too. Okay, so here you have the competing orders in the Kuberts, magnetic, superconductivity, and then you have this Fermi liquid at larger dopings. I mention this because we do also, for tutorial reasons, or I do it in my talk, the RG for the Fermi liquid. So this Kuberts FRG study only refers to this regime, because only here I'm working with weak correlations because of the large doping, large screening. Here the many body parameters are weaker, and on the overdoped side, as we call it, beyond the dome, superconducting dome, we can do an FRG also for the Kuberts. So when you see the Kuberts done, it's done in this regime. Now here the nictites have a very similar phase diagram. Again, a magnetic, however metallic phase at very low doping, not a mod insulator phase, a bad metal, antiferromagnetic phase, but in close vicinity competing with the superconducting phase. So this is a challenge for theory. How are we addressing it? Well, the point is, I would like to start with the simplest model I can think of, and of course in the Kuberts physics we love this model. This is the Hubbard model. I'm using this just to give you a flavor how the RG works. So I have a plane, let's say here, of copper ions in the Kuberts, and then I have my oxygen basically in between, and the oxygen provides, for example, these hopping terms, nearest neighbor, second nearest neighbor, and of course I have a penalty U of the order of 10 electron volt whenever I place two particles in the same site with opposite spins.
This is one band.
This is the simplest one band, and I will. This is 2D one band Hubbard model, and I'll do half filling for you. I go away from half filling, and I show you some little movie where you can see why we believe the FRG is great. Okay. So, because it does a nice job on this. So then you are all, of course, very bright, and you would ask, how can we have such a complexity from such a simplicity? I'm just having a boring structureless on-site short-range interaction. How about you? How can this give rise to this complex behavior at very low energies? Well, that's just the beauty of many-body physics. Because if you look at this diagram, and this diagram will enter all the time, so I use maybe here just for a second a picture, so I just want, I just need it for a second. So I have here, for example, if I'm interested in some pairing interaction, I have two particles with K and minus K, spin up and spin down, and then you have here interactions which I will discuss in more detail, and outcoming particles then according to the momentum of my boson type of glue, which pairs these particles, and I'm interested typically in such a picture, and this is denoted here. So here, this is K1, this is K2, and then some interaction. And then I would have my Hubbard U and many, many terms, which I'll deal with in a second, as you will see. This is my many-body problem. But the lines here in between are, of course, dynamic Green's functions. So the dynamics of the other particles is, of course, determining the effective particle-particle interaction. And you will see this leads to the diversity, the dynamics of the system. So now I have to address why do we have to do randomization group in the first place? Well, I have already sort of generally shown you I have to go down to low energies. And to understand this in more detail, look at the Cooper textbook problem of BCS theory. In the Cooper problem, what you have learned, I don't need the lights, but you have learned that if you do this calculation, or this calculation, for the electron-electron interaction, you would just screen this with a Thomas Fermi screening, and this would give you a term E squared divided by Q squared plus kappa Thomas Fermi squared, and this is high energy, because my particles are way out, this is my Fermi sphere, way out from this Fermi sphere, and the typical energy scale would be EF, or 2 times EF. On the other hand, I would do the same for the phonon channel. And then you have learned in your textbook, solid state physics lecture, that you get a term where you have the matrix element squared of coupling here and here, the phonon to the basic electronic physics, divided by omega squared minus omega phonon squared. Now, omega phonon is of the order of 10 millielectron volts. Yeah, and I see now that because of the minus sign, this channel becomes attractive at the order of 10 millielectron volts. So clearly, I have to get rid of this very large high-energy electron-electron repulsion term. And then when I have the same energy scale in this narrow blue regime here, then I can compare the two, and if I have attraction, I might win and get superconductivity. This is exactly the idea here. So we systematically integrate out the high energy physics, so to speak. For example, here, these lines I would like to integrate out, and then I have only the band energy in a narrow window, a lambda, or smaller, for example, this small regime. Okay, and I'll show you how can do this. So this is the principal idea. I would like to decrease this cutoff scale lambda and go to a regime very close to the Fermi sphere of typical order K Boltzmann times TC, because this is my superconducting energy scale. And formally, or in practice, we do this by randomization group differential equations of this term here, because they allow us to then systematically integrate out these high energy degrees of freedom. So now I come to John's question. This is the diagrammatic scheme for this. This is summarized in words here. So we have an exact flow equation. when lambda is changed on the one loop level for the so-called one particle irreducible vertices, this is many words, you don't have to know all this. Just look at a starting point at this here. So this is the derivative with respect to the cutoff of my vertex, which I plotted here. And of course, I change, as I told you before, then systematically also the cutoff in these lines here. Okay? In these diagrams here, I have inserted all the important competing fluctuations. So what are these competing fluctuations? Well, first of all, I have the Cooper channel. This was this, what I had already here. This is, for example, my glue-like phonons for pairing the particles. Of course, I have also particle hole channels. If you reverse the line going backwards, then you see that these are the typical diagrams, for example, where this is a Hubbard U giving rise to a spin flip excitation with S equal 1, and these generate the magnetic susceptibility, for example. Of course, I have screening, and I have vertex corrections. And the nice thing is here that all these fluctuations are done at the same time when I reduce the cutoff on equal footing. So diversity clearly enters here, and you will see that. Okay? Now, what is this upper line? This upper line tells you, of course, that also on the self-energy level, this is the self-energy and its derivative, I'm changing by reducing the cutoff the physics. Now, we actually at this point leave this out here. What is the major shortcoming then? What this does typically is it cuts out of the single particle excitations a gap. So there's a change due to superconductivity, to this instability in the Green's function, of course, and in the self-energy. And this is this contribution. But in first order, we can neglect this. We are actually now looking at this. But this is typically not so interesting unless you are interested in the details of the electronic excitations around the gap. We need a truncation. Now I come to John's question, because this is a coupled equation of motion for the Green's function scheme, and we need a truncation. So for example, the 6-point vertex, meaning I have 3 incoming lines here and 3 outgoing lines, is set to 0. What's the justification? Number one, on the bare level, I have no 6-point vertex because I have just 2 particle interactions, but when I have strong correlations, we know that this becomes important. So this is typically a recoupling assumption here, which we use. So now,
I guess my question was essential.
I can only make a practical statement. People like actually Carsten Honerkamp in my group have used that for the Hubbard model going up to typically half the bandwidth. So U equals 4T, AT is the non-interacting bandwidth. It works still pretty nicely. If you go beyond, you can see that you get uncontrolled results. So typically, half the bandwidth, 4T in 2 dimensions for the Hubbard model is a good result. Okay, now I have to do, of course, a practical calculation.
Before you move on, I just want to get a clear idea in the previous slide.
Okay.
When you're choosing a particular set of diagrams when you do the RG flow.
Yeah.
Fair to say that if you were able to go all the way to very low frequency, almost the ground state, if you were able to do that for very weakly coordinates, then your solution would be some version of a self-consistent Dyson equation involving this diagram. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct, because the point is, when you solve the Dyson equation at one level, you are strictly confining yourself to screening and other channels coming in at this energy, which I define in my Dyson equation. The point here is that you have included, let me make it clear in my old picture for the Cooper instability. When you have this high energy electron-electron interaction, this has this high energy scale. Now, if you do a scale transformation in RG procedure, then you actually know that means that I reduce my cutoff from lambda to lambda prime, closer to the Fermi level. You get a term which has something to do in the denominator with 1 plus ln lambda divided by lambda prime. This comes precisely from going to this new scale, and this dramatically changes the effective interactions, because that, for example, you can make an estimate, means that the typical electron-electron repulsion in aluminum is changed from 10 eV down to a factor 10 or more, smaller 1 eV or a fraction of an eV. So this randomization is very essential, and that's not embedded in the Dyson equation. But as a starting point, I could use some Dyson equation, but that's what we do. You can say these equations are, of course, basically related to general many-body theory, but then I integrate out systematically on top of this general many-body description the interaction, the high-energy physics. Okay? And you will see this. So let me continue with the practicality. The practicality means that, first of all, this function, as you see so well here, has four momenta, and let's say each of these k's comprises a momentum, a frequency, and a band index. So how are they to be simplified? Well, first of all, as you know, at all the vertices in these diagrams, I have momentum and energy conservation. So in the end of the day, this depends only on three momenta or three energies, and therefore you will see this notation here. The next point is, in order to be able to solve these coupled differential equations, I have to discretize the problem, because I've, of course, many, many k points here, in principle an infinite number, when going around the Fermi surface where the main physics is I'm interested in. So very early on, people have suggested patching this problem. This means that I choose a yellow regime, precisely indicated here, and whenever my K1, K2, and K3 are in this yellow regime, in this patch, this is taken to be a constant. This you simply have to do. You can refine it by making this thinner, but that's the technicality I have to live with. Okay? So we can also take the frequency dependence into account. So far, we have not found this to be very essential, but for certain problems, which I can discuss later, it is, I guess, important. Sorry.
What does that patch procedure correspond to the high energy?
No, this has nothing to do with the high energy. This just means that in the momentum space, I do not continuously integrate and use all the infinite number, but I use a few. And you will see this in detail, sorry, in a few minutes. I do exactly show you how this works, because I'm using a simple model where I have just two patches. Okay, so what would we get? Okay, we have here plotted, let's say, our initial matrix for the interaction, which would be of order U, let's say. This is this line. And then I systematically reduce the cutoff, and so in the end of the day, I would hopefully get a diverging channel with the most leading divergence, and this would, for example, be my superconducting channel. Okay? So this is the general thing I'm interested in. I would like to look at the low energy physics. Now, the nice thing here, one nice thing is that, but that's of course only a rough statement, but roughly speaking, where the divergence sets in, this is an upper bound for TC. So this lambda C, where this diverges, is an upper bound for TC. This is also interesting or important, at least for a gross estimation of the corresponding instability temperature-wise. So now I come to this example I have promised you, namely, I start with the simplest Cooper 2D Hubbard model everybody knows. How do I see then some nice physics with this scheme? Okay? So I look at such a green soccer field. Now my soccer field has actually two numbers, K1 going up. This is the incoming momentum, the first one, and this is the second incoming momentum. So these are these two incoming momenta. So for example, in the superconducting channel, this would be K1 equals minus K2, okay? Now the patching here, you see here in terms of these numbers, the patching is here done specifically in this calculation going up to 9. So here I have 9 or 10K points, 10K points, or 9K points, and 9K points, 9K points. So roughly speaking, I have these K points. Okay, so this is the patching. So I take a Hubbard model with a weak correlation, 2T, no next nearest neighbor hopping, low temperatures, and I fix the K3 just to give you a plot here in two dimensions. I have to fix my K3, the outgoing one, at this point 1. So K3 is fixed to this point 1. Okay, and now I'm looking at the dependence on the two momenta K1 and K2, and the K4, as I told you before, is fixed by momentum conservation. I start with a cutoff which is half the bandwidth, so for me this is high energy physics. Okay, so now very boring, just a soccer field. Now you see, if I reduce the cutoff by a factor of 10, I start seeing a certain intensive structure, here still yellow, at point 24. Now remember, my point was here 1, the K3, so I'm scattering from here to here or from here to here. Well, this is clearly a pi-pi scattering process, and of course that just means that I'm looking at the anti-ferromagnetic two-dimensional order, and I see the corresponding correlations giving rise to this tendency of an instability at higher temperature. Here?
Like you've got a yellow patch at K.
Oh, this is some scale.
24.
Yeah.
No, the numbers on the.
Oh, this means I'm going here in the direction up. So I'm going basically around here. This is the patching. This is the patching number. So I know when I'm at 24, I'm here. This is my point 24. Okay? I make it very precise in the next picture. Let me just continue. So this thing here gets red, gets very intensive at this point, and then in the end of the day gets even more reddish, and then you have this condition when I have reduced my energy scale by a factor of 50, I have this instability coming up, very popping up very intensively, which means that K2 minus K3 is just pi-pi. So I'm scattering from here to here, and this nesting scattering induces this strong instability. In fact, you can also calculate, if you like, in the scheme, the corresponding spin sensitivity, and this diverges. So this means I'm scattering, like you know, from a cone anomaly with 2kF from here to here, and this induces some instability. Exactly, on some scale. This is positive, this is negative, this will also play a role. Yeah. That's correct. Okay, so now I'm going to a much more interesting example where I see also the beauty of other competing channels coming in. So again, I start with the soccer field at half the bandwidth, but now I'm looking at an imperfectly nested Hubbard model, which I'm really using, or many people are using, like Dark's group, and we have done calculations, doped away from half filling, so this is 14% doping, this model. This means I allow for frustration, so this determines here this Fermi surface sheet no longer being the square, and in fact the Fermi surface is very close to the experiments, so this is not an unrealistic example. And now I do the same type of RG scheme. Okay, I start with high energy, and now I'm going down. So first you see, not surprisingly, that there is a mild divergence still around 24 of the spin density wave channel. What is this due to? Well, we can look into more details, but this means that still, even at such a relatively large doping, the spins are interferromagnetically short-range ordered. So there's still some fluctuation of interferromagnetic spin density wave character. This is this here. And this happens at a scale 1 over 20 of the bandwidth, typically. At, if you like, because this is an upper bound for TC at higher energies, higher temperatures. So then I lower the energy or the temperature, and popping up comes something in addition here. And I see also then suddenly negative regimes popping up. So let's further cut down this thing here. And then you see, wow, this gets very pronounced, and this gets very pronounced negative, this is very pronounced positive, and it has a diagonal, clearly diagonal direction. So this is clearly the superconducting channel which develops at lower cutoffs or lower energy scales, or TC, also TC scales. So this is the scale where the channel where I have K1 being minus K2, and this is the Cooper channel which signals superconducting instability. And this then even gives you the correct D-wave nodal behavior, namely if you go, this was your question, Phil, if you go around, let's say, to point 16 here, this is about here, and then I'm going in this regime, and I come to this point where I change the character of the superconducting gap, as you see. So I come at 25 at this thing, so I'm going through here, and then suddenly it is positive, and again, if I go further on, it gets negative. So this is exactly this flower structure of the D-wave superconductor. That's correct, but they we can go into the details. They are related. You're right. I'm looking at this point at the interaction, but this is related to this order parameter in the sense, as you know, that, for example, if I have repulsive V, loosely speaking, then I have to introduce a D-wave or a nodal behavior. If it's attractive, then I have to I can get away without nodes. So they are related. But I can, we can later discuss this in detail. So now I come in the last part quickly, because in a certain way, this is very similar to the iron pnictides, okay? And I told you already what I'm interested in. I'm interested in because quite naturally, Hubbard U is small, smaller than in the cuprides. This is from constraint density functional theory. And in particular, all five iron orbitals, at least, if not the p orbitals, contribute to the physics at the Fermi level. So I'm interested in what is material dependent, like the orbital physics could be, what is general in this issue. And I told you already, the emergent orders overall are rather similar. I always have a magnetic phase in close competition with a superconducting phase for different materials of these families. Okay, now this is not interesting to you. This was more the motivation for the experts why we did this. But in general, as I said, once again, what is the universal behavior? What is the material dependent behavior? Now we started out with a picture, which I also would like to mention because it gives you a feeling for the patching. So what would be the simplest patching or discretizing feature I could choose? I have these, for example, at the gamma point, hole pockets or hole pocket, and I have the electron pockets at the end point. What could I do as the simplest RG type of scheme? The simplest one would be that I'm saying, okay, I'm so close to half filling that I'm just touching these bands, and then these pockets would be contracted to a point. and also this pocket to a point. So if this is the case, and this was the assumption of a guy known in our field, namely Chubukov, and they said, well, let's do the so-called geology for these materials. This means that I'm working now not with the full matrix, but I'm contracting this matrix V with the three momenta and the fourth one being fixed to just one scalar like G1. Okay, if you look at these possibilities, you have, of course, scatterings from one point or patch to the next one. With this constant, this means an electron hole type of process. This means a pair scattering, and these are inter-pocket scatterings. So in the end of the day, if you respect the electron hole symmetry, you have these four couplings. Okay, this is very similar, topologically equivalent, to what you can do and has been done by Maurice Rice and co-workers about 10, 11 years ago for the cuprates on the overdoped side, so to speak, where I can reliably use the scheme. They have also said, let's do a gross simplification, which certainly is not justified very well for the overdoped side, but let's also use a patching model. Just these pi zero, in this case, dots, just contract the pockets to a dot. And then we have exactly the same topology, if you like. You have these four coupling constants, you get four equations, and in the end of the day, you can do this analytically, and you can see that you have a flow to strong coupling, as I've shown you before, that happens when I go to low energy. And the point is that these coupling constants diverge. For example, G2 and G3 go to infinity, G4 goes to minus infinity. You can simply do this here. And then you would see, since the SDW instability, you just have to believe me, this is determined by G2 plus G3, or the pairing by G3 minus G4, this going to infinity, I would always get, so to speak, twice infinity for the strength of the instability. So in plain English, this means that several channels diverge, driven by the same umklapp process, or the strength, or the scale where this takes off is identical. Okay, but this is not the correct physics. You cannot have one, you must have one winning channel alone, because we know in the pnictides, in principle as well as in the cuprates, I have shown you that at half filling I get an SDW, if I dope I get as a winner the superconducting channel. So this cannot work, and I've given you reasons why it doesn't work in detail. This is overdope quite naturally, and here we'll see in a minute why it doesn't work. We have to take the orbital physics of these compounds into account and work with extended Fermi surface sheets.
Are you saying that theoretically it's just experiment that tells you the difference?
No, let me repeat it. If I do this type of very simplified scheme, then you would say, okay, at least at half filling, where this is roughly 2, because I might have just very little doping so that this goes down to just one point, a pocket, then I should, of course, have at the half filled situation that the SDW wins. But it doesn't, because the SDW, take these two numbers, gives, I mean, simply said, twice infinity, but this also gives twice infinity.
Yeah, I know. And
so there's no winner.
So 5, and I don't understand. The idea was both things diverge. Does that mean you have both orders simultaneously?
They diverge with the same, so they are lying top on top if I reduce lambda. I show you now this is not the case if I do the calculation correctly, meaning I have to take some material physics into account, namely the orbital content. If you do this, then, for example, at half filling, they both diverge, but the winner is the SDW.
Is there, is it possible to take both?
here it is. That's theoretically possible.
And if they both win, what's the physics of the new phase?
Well, this is complicated. I mean, we can, again, this is a point we can discuss later. There is some recent work which claims that this is not so crazy in the Cooperites and has to do with an even more extended symmetry beyond our SO5 symmetry, having to do with an SO6 symmetry. There were some Russians doing this. We can go into this. And sort of more physically speaking, the claim is that for the Cooperites, this could be due to the pseudo-gap physics, into which I don't want to go here. But the pseudo-gap physics can play a role so that the instabilities are hindered at the energy scales we are considering here, and you need a more complex calculation to reveal the winner, but not along the lines in the Pnictides. In the Pnictides, as I'll show you, you can stay with the scheme, but do you take the final extent of these pockets into account and the orbital content. So this is my next point. So my next point is, in the Pnictides, I have to really treat the, and now I get a division. In the end of the day, maybe in 15 minutes, I hope I can tell you, yes, also in the Pnictides, we have the SDW as the generic, general unifying picture, but the details are determined by the band structure, how the orbital weights are distributed along these pockets. So this is what I'm now working on. So how can we do this? So in order to illustrate this, we can still take this Chubakov or whatever you want to call it model as a starting point. So as a starting point, I'm not doing this in my last step, but as an intermediate step, in order to show you what comes out if I allow more flexibility in the RG calculation, I start out with constants between the pockets, but when I flow, integrate out the high energy degrees of freedom, I am taking this beautiful patching into account and allow for the matrix character. So I will show you this in a picture in a minute. So this means I'm starting out with this interaction, which is in a certain pocket just a constant. This is a pocket because I'm going around. I told you here in this circle. So I'm in a certain pocket. I'm in a certain pocket here and so on. My initial condition is that this is constant, like I did it before. But now I allow it, for the flow so that this is mixed in a flower bed way completely because of the randomization group flow. And then you see, if I'm at half filling, again I get these vertical lines, these here, so they tell me that, and this was your question, yes, indeed, the SDW, the magnetic instability, is the winner. And this also diverges, but is not coming up. I mean, of course, you have to check this way down. But this is the pairing instability. So indeed, here I do get correctly in the undoped system that the magnetic physics is the winner.
So, underlying hypothesis is something that you have to the band topology with unknown interaction.
Well, no, wait a moment. I mean, that's my main point. We did these calculations assuming the fit to the LDA density functional band structure. This was my H0 Hamiltonian. And then I added, like the community does right now, this interaction Hamiltonian with the four constants, which are related by this two-body interaction assumption. Okay. For me, this is still a kind of preliminary stage, and that's exactly why I'm here. This is the $20 thing. I'm interested because there's no reason I cannot start from, let's say, a much more a priori type of high energy calculation. What do I mean by that? Let's say I have a density dynamic mean field type of calculation, which is also not what I have in mind in the end of the day, but just to give you a flavor. I do a type binding fit to the band structure, I have double counting. So I have to correct for double counting, and we know how to do this, so the one particle energies are corrected. And then I have a dynamical mean field theory we which is self-consistently done, so I get some estimates at least for these interaction parameters. This would be for me already an order of magnitude better for me, because I get some reliable estimates for these parameters. At this point, the community in the MNICDITES, of course, they are not going blind, so they have played with these parameters and have good physical arguments, but this is still try and see to a certain extent, and it can be done better.
So the answer is the fact that the green STW is winning is a consequence of a topology which agrees with density, a band topology agreeing with DFT.
Yes.
And an initial ordering of your G1, G2, G3, G4 that's consistent.
Okay. Yeah, but I mean, it's not blind. That would be very unfair, because people like Doug sitting here, they have, of course, used parameters. For example, the Hubbard U, I told you, was extracted from number one constraint density functional calculation, so we know it's of the order between 2 eV and 4 eV. And of course, also we know it from other experiments, photo emission experiments, for example, of C.X. Shen's group. I cited this was about 2 eV as an estimate. So it's not that these numbers are just totally unknown. And if you use a U between 2 eV and 4 eV, also in the RPA, you beautifully confirm this STW instability. Yeah. So it's not that I wanted only to say it more dramatically, because I want to earn my $20. But I think it is in this scheme, which is very powerful, I can do more or better and start from kind of first principle, many body Hamiltonian. Yeah, if you can give me a high energy Hamiltonian, including the interactions, which is precise, at least roughly, within 5, 10, 20%. Okay, so this was half filling, and we see the STW winning. So now let's see if we do the same game, whether in the dope case, again starting from these constants, but now we're normalizing it, what do we get then? Then we get from this type of flower bed, we get this ordered flower bed. And now you see something interesting. This is the same. I'm starting out with this type of air couplings, and then I renormalize down, and this is my low cutoff result, where again this plots K1 and this plots K2. This is K1 and this is K2. The doping enters into H0. The H0 Hamiltonian, density functional Hamiltonian, of course, contains the doping via mu and the change of the bands. Okay, this is the density functional Hamiltonian. The pockets are changed, the magnetic, the orbital weights around the pockets are changed. That's a standard density functional calculation now for a typically 10% dope. I think this is 10% electron doped system.
The picture is changing some of the genes, or it's changing the topology.
That changes the numbers of the G of these G's slightly, but that's not the main effect. I can even start with the same couplings as in the half-filled situation, and I would still get this as a pretty robust outcome. And the pretty robust outcome is that now you see something very interesting. In addition to vertical lines, which however are of course also these remnants of the pockets, I see again here the diagonal physics coming up. And this is exactly the superconducting K1 minus K2 channel. And now you see something very interesting, which people believe in the MNICDITES, namely if I go from one pocket to this pocket, from this pocket, this is always going around here, so this means I'm in one pocket, for example, the gamma point pocket, and I'm going to the N pocket, to the gamma point pocket, I'm getting a very positive red signal in the superconducting channel. Here I get a blue negative, red positive charge. And this means that I have a so-called sine reversed S wave pairing, because you can then further analyze the superconducting symmetry of the ground state and find that it has the extended S wave. But the nice thing,
all electron pockets have opposite sign.
Yes, absolutely. That's what it means. That's what I said in the beginning. Due to the Fermi surface sheets and the interesting new topology, we can have very different physics from the Cooperians. But this, in our opinion, is material-oriented physics, changing the sign between these pockets. Okay? And accordingly, this extended S-wave pairing channel diverges, whereas the SDW is now suppressed. Okay? So this was nearly the last thing, or 5 more minutes, namely, I promised you also a statement about TC. So what we did, or my student did, for example, here, is he played around with these coupling constants. So the question is, what drives the higher TC in this case? This is, by the way, hole doping, and this is electron doping. You can dope these materials in both directions. So what is this G3? I have to go back. G3, you can see, is the pair hopping term between the pockets. So this is obviously an important ingredient which we would like to understand much better from a priori calculations for the $20 here, because this, in the end of the day of our calculation, determines the TC behavior versus doping. So this is small G3, this is a larger G3. So let me summarize. We could, for example, say, okay, model dependence 1, this multi-channel instability where all the channels diverge with the same intensity as we have discussed, which is unphysical, is removed when we allow for the K-space nature of this pairing channel here. Okay. We still get a very isotropic extended S wave gap. That means, looking at this, this is just some cosine and a little wiggle. This is the first pocket being positive. This is the next pocket being negative, plotted here positive, negative. And this is this extended S wave. So on this pocket, I have a positive gap. Here I have a negative gap with mild oscillations. Now, some experiments find rather dramatic oscillations in the literature of these gaps. So how can they come along? Well, we do the material physics one step further, and this is what I really would like to get from you, but I don't have it. So I'm still using density functional theory. I'm using these interaction parameters as good as we can determine them. For example, from Doug Scalapino's density functional fit, we would get this. And now the orbitals are showing up, popping up, in terms of these weights, dominant weights, at the pockets, for example, at the gamma point or at the M point. Now I do the full, or my friend Christian, he does the full calculation. So we take the flower bed, leave K1 and K2 open as the two incoming channels, and again fix this point just for plotting it as a 2D plot here. We have to fix that, so that means we fix it at a certain point here. And this means that we work in the dominant band. This is the band 3 here. This is this is the 2D plot. So I'm plotting K1 and K2. I do the 5-band, or he does the 5-band flow. And then you see out of the flower bed, I get a nice structure displaying, like in the Cooperians, two dominant instabilities, one going straight. This you know already. This is the zero pi spin momentum instability. I could now show you, if I go down in cutoff, first this channel develops, and this gives me therefore the glue for pairing. And then at lower cutoffs, I develop this diagonal one, again, positive, negative, and so on. This means I have different gaps, positive and negative, on these pockets. So in the end of the day, I can summarize all this. Now I could go into the details, I'm not going to do this. And come to what, at least at this point, we can say about the Bnictides. What is universal? what in our opinion is universal is whether I consider this trivial two-point or two-patch model, whether I do this then dress with the many-body interactions to get a V matrix, or I start right away from a holistic five-orbital model. The FRG clearly suggests that both in the couplets and in the plectrodes, the superconductivity is driven by electronic physics and by magnetic spin density wave-like physics. Okay, so this is the universal statement. Now I could show you that details of how the gap anisotropy is looking. That comes because of the orbital content. This is clearly material physics. We can work this out. So for example, yeah, you see I can have nodes here. So I can look at very anisotropic gap behavior, but these are material details. And in that sense, this is my last few graphs. I think this scheme is really very powerful. What it is missing, I'm a newcomer in this, so I learned it really from with my students in the last 1.5 years, because I'd always underestimated this scheme, because we did lots of other things, analytical symmetry and cluster techniques. This, however, is a very nice, powerful scheme. What, in my opinion, it misses, and I hope this was my main message I wanted to bring over, I need to connect it. I need not to stop at this model interaction. I can do much better. I can start from a GW, if you like, calculation. Nobody can prevent me from doing that. I can start from a DFT plus DMFT calculation. And we are in the middle of discussing what would be best for a good starting point. And if you could help me, then I would be more than delighted. Thank you for your attention.
Get back to my question again, but in the so if I were to take any model and I decided to solve a specific set type, say flash type, for example, and just solve it directly, and if there so happened that there is instability somewhere, the sensibility out of the flex calculation will eventually diverge at certain temperature.
Absolutely.
Don't mean now that using the RG with exactly the same set of diagram, you're going to get a different temperature.
No, you're not using exactly the same set of diagram. That's exactly the point. If you would do a flex calculation or an RPA, I call flex a symmetrized RPA, so it's symmetric in the particle-particle-particle-hole channel. If you do that, you find, of course, an instability, like in the RPA, as I said, for example, in the spin channel, but you would not have the instability also popping up at the same time in the superconducting channel. You have not included this effect of the superconducting fluctuations becoming very strong on your spin density wave instability. That you have not included, yeah? Because you are not even caring about the superconducting instability. That's why, really, let me make it a very strong statement, but that's correct. The FRG is beyond mean field. The RPA of flex is mean field. That's the physics. I'm saying that when I look, and I've shown you this hopefully in this picture, I don't know whether I'm quick enough, exactly here. So I'm doing the D wave pairing for the couplets. So here I see that the influence of the spin density wave, and I know exactly how long it is important. It is important at a higher temperature. Obviously, we know the Néel temperature is 300 K in the couplets. So this is still an intermediate or higher energy scale, where I first have this instability. Now at this point you can say, why do I care about this instability? That's very important for the physics, because if you have your, say, short-range spin density wave or interferometric magnetic arrangement, it's exactly like a mattress where you put shot put, a very heavy ball, and this shot put makes a hole into the mattress, and then a second shot put, my second electron, pops into this first hole. So you are changing the short-range anti-ferromagnetic behavior by having an electron at one side. A second electron sees that and falls into this hole. That's the mechanism behind the pairing in this model. So first I have to have a short-range mattress, and this is this. This is provided at higher energies, higher TCs first, and then when I go down, I see, so to speak, that the electrons or particles are falling into this hole, into this spin bag. And that's what you don't have in an RPA. You don't have in an RPA, you can look at the spin channel alone or at the charge superconducting channel alone, but not at the simultaneous influence of these other processes onto the superconducting channel.
Simplest model that has basic shifts. Calculate its ground state density, then you go backwards and you calculate the exact non-interacting potential that gives you that density, and then that gives you an effective sort of band structure. Because that contains in it the information about the strength of the new J5 and so forth, right? Are all in there. So by doing that, you can always adjust those numbers and look what the effective band structure is and match it to the Cohn-Cham band structure that you get from the LDA or GGA calculation. But then that's a way of telling you within the model what are the important, what are the relevant parameters, play with them and see what happens to the pockets and vertices. And I think that's a more direct way. It avoids all the double counting and everything. And the only approximation left is that you're approximating the full thing by the model, which is really thing that you want.
Is the thing you want the matrix elements of Coulomb interactions from the Cohn-Cham states that he's talking about? Not the Cohn-Cham potential, but the original interaction.
No, what I just described is what you really want. What you're saying is what people often say they think they want.
It's perfectly sensible. They don't get it. What do you think is really wanted?
Because that's for a weakly correlated system, that's true, right? But for when there are stronger correlations going on, this is a unique mapping that only depends on the approximation that you made your simple model, right? Which captures the many body physics, right? And this could be done with the five orbital model as well as with the simpler one.
Well,
Ferdinand Ehrling, who was a very good postdoc, did this at Karlsruhe for the problem of transport wire. They had a chain model, and they did DMRG, and they figured out how to get the transmission through the wire from the DMRG, but then they went backwards and constructed the Cohn-Cham potential and looked at its transmission properties in order to see the errors made by the standard.
Well, we have to sit down, because of course I have also learned my Cohn-Cham, because I've worked with Walter many years. So we have to sit down in the sense that what is really required is a Hamiltonian which contains, so to speak, the also excitations. I mean, in the sense that this H1 Hamiltonian is at a scale where I expect that dynamic screening processes have already a certain renormalization of the Baer-Coulomb interactions and so on. So we have to sit down. I think that's a delicate issue.
You have all that within your simple model.
Right? Yeah, that's right. In the model, I have it.
Right. So all I'm talking about is the model of reverse engineering and how to identify the parameters in that model with the band structure calculation.
I also want to make clear, because this touches upon this, you can also argue, why doesn't he then do an LDA plus DMFT calculation? That's a totally different issue, not doing again this job so accurately. This typically has, from numerical recipes, already difficulties. Like, I mean, you know, there are beautiful DCA cluster calculations for the Hubbard model, but even for the simple Hubbard model, people have to use a Monte Carlo scheme, and then you get minus sun problems. You cannot go to the very low temperatures we are addressing here. The beauty here is I can go down to the ground state or extremely low temperatures from above in a totally controlled manner. That's the beauty. What is not so beautiful, but that's still has to be done, is the starting point. I think we can improve, as you just discussed, on the starting point. Because the starting point here in this field, quite generally, is in my opinion, okay, because these people, you have also to see, these people come from my side, so to speak, meaning from the many-body physics side, as I call it. They don't care whether the U is twice as big or the J is twice as big, as long as it's somewhere there, and then they say, oh, the Hubbard U does the job, or the Hunsrück coupling does the job. They understand the physics. But I think it is time to merge with the two visions or ideas, and that's why I also hopefully didn't overdo my job, but I wanted to explain also pedagogically what goes into such a calculation. But the beauty is that the FRG itself is not limited. I can start from a very general many-body problem.
I can say it another way, which is, you said when you're in the band structure, how much you write in your simple model, you match it to the tight binding of the DFT. But since your system is strongly correlated, what I was describing was the sort of right way of doing that, which is you take the solution of your correlated system, go backwards and ask what would an exact Cohen-Chaum DFT calculation, what would its band structure look like, and then that's what matched to the real band structure. Because that way, because the LDA or GDA is getting these large energy scales right in some mean field way, that's the information that it's telling you not tight binding.
Yeah, I'm very interested in this. I can see you sit already closest to the $20.
Okay.
Sorry.
I have a different shot on this.
So you dismissed the phonons early on.
Yeah, okay, so that's a good question. It's always a good question. It's an easy question, but it's a good question.
The question is, okay. Completely dismiss them now after
that. I'm not willing to dismiss them in a longer term, meaning in the next 2 years. The reason is there are very interesting isotope effects showing that the iron has a very strong isotope effect of nearly 0.5. You know, 0.5 is the maximum in BCS theory. So the question is, where does this come from? In my opinion, it comes from a very definite magnon phonon or magnon lattice coupling. Because these things I showed you before on the Hunsrück coupling, there are a number of PILs and other works around which show if you press the C axis, you press the C axis towards the plane, you lower the iron magnetic moment. So clearly there is a magnetic structure coupling. And I'm sure that plays a role.
let me give you another shot on the Twin Towers. What if you just go back to first principle Hamiltonian, the fully bare Hamiltonian, the way people set up a GW calculation? There is no double counting, there is no model parameter, everything bare. You start with a complete set of Hamiltonian, complete set of bases. You can treat the high energy part exactly at the level of a charge fluctuation. So you can drop all the diagram except the GW diagram, just the RPA charge fluctuation. Do your RG all the way down to 20 eV. As soon as you pass the plasmon frequency, you're basically home free. Then the parameter will become stabilized. It will converge to a point. Then you start to switch on the spin fluctuation and your pair-pair correlation function in your RG. Then you keep flowing. Just stop on the beginning doing first principle.
Yeah, I'm a big fan because, well, it's not nice to say that, but I think we did the first GW calculations in the world on insulators in 1980-81, but I have learned that this has become, of course, much more refined, and I have learned that in the nictites, there's no GW calculation around, so we may ask, why didn't people do this? This obvious. It's a weakly correlated metal, I can do that. It's not trivial, because even a plain GW calculation in the nictites, you have to carefully involve the spin susceptibilities, the charge susceptibilities, all the cross terms. So the fact is, Silke Biermann told me that a Japanese group seems to have undertaken a calculation. You may know that. But I have definitely not seen up today a GW calculation for the nictites.
Don't do GW.
In principle, yes, but...
Do your RG from the beginning, using the fully first principle bare Hamiltonian. Do your RG from the very high energy, but using the oversimplified diagram, like charge fluctuation bubble, until you pass the plasmon frequency. Then you can switch on the rest of the bubble, because I don't believe that this spin fluctuation and pair correlation would be even relevant at the plasmon frequency, right? That's too high energy. So do your RG from the beginning, from day one, and just use an oversimplified charge fluctuation diagram.
Well, we have to sit down. We tried to do this in the Cooper. It's not a very powerful way of doing this. It's much better you start from an intermediate scale, like TJ, or let's say from the Hubbard model, where I have already integrated out many high energy degrees of freedom. And that makes your life much simpler.
Then you never get rid of the issue of double counting, and you never get rid of the issue of how do you get...
I think even at this intermediate level, maybe due to what you discussed, you can correctly take double counting into account. I think so. It's done in the DMFT, for example. I mean, I know that.
That's an unsolved problem in DMFT.
No. The procedure I described is a little bit...
Yeah.
Can I make a comment on it?
Yes.
I think the procedure physically is very appealing, but in practice, it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to do, because the model is very, very simple. First of all, it's difficult even with the model to get a density. Second of all, if you get a density, it's very wrong in that it has a small basis, one way to think about it. You know, I just take a few atomic basis functions. So the density, many-body density, compared to one-body DFT density, could be much worse. That happens, in fact, in many, QMC calculations. If you take a small basis, you come up with forces or densities that are much worse than DFT. So by using a model, you're constrained already to a very limited basis. The density you get will have nothing to do with what you really want in the true hypothetical calculation.
Well, but none of that sort of...
You know, think of the Hubbard model, right? He's doing it. That's one example where you would get a flat density. There would be nothing in it.
Yeah, but no, that really isn't an issue, because you started by looking at the bands, right? So one thing is, it's very straightforward now. Once you have one body density, there are many algorithms by which you can construct this cone channel potential. And of course, because the model is very simple, the potential could look very bad because of the limited basis set and so forth. But, you know, if you're reasonable, if you think about it for a little bit, you can make it work, looking much more like a type binding model. But since you look at the bands and you get the T's and things like that from the bands, that exact procedure, you know, so yes, of course.
It's not reversible. The other way, once you look at the band, you ungrass it to the simple model.
Yeah, but in the end, you're going to end up with a cone sham potential with simple bands.
But your density doesn't force it.
That's the whole point. Because you're using the ground state density.
Is the coherence also in the mix size?
For the spin? It's a few lattice parameters. It's a bit longer for a typical doping. Let's say we looked, the question was, what is the coherence length as a function of doping, obviously. That is material dependent, but let's say overall it is a little bit longer if you want. But this depends because you have a metallic system, so you could also argue the screening is more effective and disrupts the interferomagnetic order. So, but typically at 10% you have 1-2 lattice parameters correlation length for the interferomagnetic ordering. So it's similar to the Cooper.
Let me ask one interesting question. I think would be related to the method. So it's clear that this method, because of the derived from diagram of some low order diagram, it cannot handle really strong Ecoli system. So has anybody done RG just using the same way to look at the Hubble model with only first neighbor, so the most unstable Hubble model, with very tiny bit of doping but very large interaction? Because there you expect some kind of weak ferromagnetism, right? I'm just curious whether you can ever get the
cycle. Ferromagnetic?
The ferromagnetic. If you don't have a model, a little bit of doping, it becomes ferromagnetic. Right?
Yeah, okay.
I'm wondering whether you can ever see the sign change in this case.
No. What people have done precisely using this is, I can tell you, because we are working right now on the ruthenates. And the ruthenates, P-wave superconductors, of course, you would like to have a ferromagnetic instability nearby. So what you can do is you can do exactly the same calculation, but now let's say fix your doping, but do it as a function of T prime. Now when T prime goes up to about 0.4, 0.5, you see that you have other nesting features which favor a Q tending to zero ferromagnetic instability. And close to that ferromagnetic instability, we found that the P wave superconducting channel diverges. So again, when we saw that, we said, okay, the years of the simple Hubbert model are gone. Let's take a more detailed band structure. There are Igor Mazin and Ovchinnikov are some experts on this. And so we can take that and we get very interesting results. But this is again on this sort of semi first principle, semi model basis. And we would like to go beyond that.
But that's when you have a weak, the Fermi surface netting is a weak coupling feature. I'm saying that if you take a pure Hubbert model, no key prime, just key only, and dope with a little bit.
Yeah, but we cannot crank up, I mean, yeah, people have done this, but we cannot crank up, as I said, the Hubbert U beyond the bare bandwidth, which is of order 8T. In two dimensions. So 4T is roughly the reliability limit for the Hubbert U we can use, even close to half filling.
But if you just doesn't plug it blindly, would you see the sign change at all?
What's it?
If you plug in your formula, your transistor, regardless that you decide, you just put U equal to 8,
yeah,
8T, and put a little hole into the system, would you be able to see the ferromagnetic instability?
No, because we haven't, I don't know whether people looked at it, because I would never do a calculation in weak coupling where my order parameter, the expansion parameter is 2. I would rather have 1/2 at least.
Okay.
Let's talk about we have 2. Let's stand up.